This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
On Keeping the Faith this afternoon, we're starting off in a little bit of an unusual way. We're announcing a recent marriage between Rafe Melhado and Jessica Cavanaugh. Congratulations, folks. Can you hear me?
Thank you.
Hi, you can't hear me. Well, and when exactly were you married?
2 weeks ago today, actually.
On a Sunday, 2 weeks ago.
Yes.
And where were you married?
At the Alumni Center on the University of Illinois campus.
And why did you pick that particular place?
Well, the University of Illinois is where we met, and at the Hillel Foundation on campus, and it seemed like an appropriate place, and also that they would allow us to bring in a kosher caterer, which was important to us.
And Rafe, you were the groom at this ceremony. Can you hear me all right?
Yes, I can.
We're talking with Rafe and Jessica via phone, and where are you exactly about right now as we're talking to you?
We're sitting in our apartment up in Lakeview, Illinois.
Lakeview. Where exactly is Lakeview?
It's a neighborhood in Chicago that's about a mile south of Wrigley Stadium.
Ah, so you had something to celebrate today if you're a Cub fan.
We don't pay too much attention to sports, although we figure since we're so close, we should probably go at least once.
It'll be hard to get a ticket now. So you said you met at the university at the Hillel Foundation. Our topic today, more seriously, is the year of study that the two of you did in Jerusalem, Jewish studies. But let's talk just a little bit about your wedding. What is an Orthodox Jewish wedding like?
Actually, fairly complicated and pretty raucous. How much time do we have to explain it?
Well, tell us about the raucous part at least.
Alrighty. Well, it begins with a couple of separate receptions. The bride and groom aren't supposed to see each other before the wedding. So the groom has one reception in one place, and the bride has another reception in another place. Now, there's a tradition for there to be a lot of singing and actually a bit of drinking and carrying on during those receptions. And the bride and the groom are supposed to have prepared a word of Torah, except that everybody knows they'll be really nervous, so the guests kind of heckle them in the middle of their homiletic, so that they can't really finish.
Now let's talk about some of the words you've used. A word of Torah. Tell us what Torah is.
Torah is the Pentateuch, that is to say, the five books of Moses, that is at the beginning of the Bible. And usually, when Jews talk about Torah, they mean the whole Old Testament.
And so you each select something, a short passage or a phrase or...
Well, usually it's traditional to choose something from the week's Torah portion. Now, it happens, basically Jews read a bit of the Torah during services every Saturday morning, such that by reading a little bit every week, they finish the whole Torah every year. Now, I'm saying Torah now, I mean only the five books of Moses.
And so what did you select, Rafe, to read and surprise Jessica with?
The previous week's portion, which, keeping in mind, we read on the Saturday before we got married, interested me because it has this long portion where it talks about all the nasty things that would happen to the Jews if they don't pay attention to God's commandments. And I thought, gee, that's just a terrible thing to have read right before your wedding.
Not very positive and uplifting.
That's right. So I thought maybe I could put a positive spin on that passage. So I talked a little bit about the idea that, well, it's such a scary passage that in services we actually read it really fast and really quiet. And I thought it was interesting that we did that instead of just not reading it at all. Maybe we'd skip that because it was such a difficult subject matter. But no, even though we read it with trepidation, we still read it. And I thought that analogy played over very nicely into married life. That is to say, you're with your spouse for the good stuff and the bad, and that even when things get a little tough, you don't just skip that. you read it, if you will. You stay with the other person, you work through it.
And Jessica, what did you pick to read?
I actually made a connection between that week's Parsha and my Bat Mitzvah portion, Torah portion, which is the other section in the Torah that has similar kinds of curses, if you will. And sort of, so both occasions I had these sort of not-so-happy readings on an occasion that was supposed to be very happy. But the idea in each of the curses, that the reason that they're different is that one is in a plural, as in you all are, you know, will be cursed in such in the following way. And the later on when the second set of curses are in singular, as in you as one person. Now, why, if you're talking to the whole group, are you only going to say it in a singular? And the idea being that you can say it in the singular because the people of Israel understand that one person equals the entire group, and sort of bring that idea back to the idea that, you know, we're sharing, you know, one of us is both of us, and we share sort of equally in things, and that one thing doesn't just affect one of us, it now affects both of us.
Now, we started off talking about your wedding ceremony and what was all part of a Jewish Orthodox service, and you said that it was gets very raucous. Now, this sounds very serious and quite sobering, actually.
Yeah.
Well, very, very appropriate, but when did the fun start?
Well, I mean, you remember that we're being heckled in the middle of this. So as we're trying to give a very serious homiletic, people are interrupting us with songs and dance and toasts. So that was a little raucous. But
and a homiletic is an interpretation.
That's right.
Okay. So you're sort of giving a mini sermon, at least that would be the word in a Christian tradition, based on that text.
Okay. So what happens next is that you would go and sign an agreement that says, I commit myself to getting engaged. And this sounds a little weird because you think, well, gee, if you're getting married, you'd have been engaged already. And the trouble is that engagement in Judaism is a legal agreement. And if you get engaged to somebody and then you want to get divorced, or you don't want to marry them, essentially, that you have to get divorced. So people don't want to commit themselves to that degree until the day of the wedding. So you go out and you sign a document committing yourself to get engaged. And, again, you're wondering, well, where is the ruckus coming in? I remember talking to the videographer about this moment, and I said, we will be danced outside. And she said to me, well, what does that mean, you'll be danced outside? Like, there's some kind of formal processional or something? I said, oh no, people are going to gather around us in a big crowd and sort of jump around and sing and shout, and there'll be a lot of volume, and they'll literally accompany us outside the building to where we'll be signing these documents. And then once they're signed, again, we are danced quite literally together for the wedding processional. So again, there's a lot of raucous jumping up and down and sort of singing these very happy tunes that goes along. So then we get the wedding processional, and the next elements you need in a Jewish wedding are a formal engagement ceremony, and then you have to sign a marriage contract. And what that does is it acknowledges way back in the Middle Ages when women didn't have a very good financial situation. It's a document where the husband says, I obligate myself to take care of you, all of your needs. I will support you, I will feed you, I will clothe you. And if, God forbid, I should die or we should get divorced, then I'm going to obligate myself to these very specific financial obligations to support you. So it's sort of like alimony, essentially. And then...
Now, this document is called the Ketubah?
That's correct.
And what does the bride obligate herself for?
Really just to be my wife.
And Jessica, how did you feel about that? Did it seem uneven?
I think... In a way, it does, but I think also the previous document that we had signed before the ketubah was much more about our commitment to one another. So there were aspects of that we talked about before we signed the ketubah. And then the ketubah is a very formulaic and not particularly romantic document that's been around for hundreds and hundreds of years. And the idea of, you know, is it equal or is it not equal, it's more about this is what you need to get married. Uh-huh. So you sign it, and it's really sort of, it's about the obligations. Just thinking about when it came into being, you know, the Middle Ages, you know, when women really didn't have any of these, you know, weren't guaranteed these rights. There wasn't, you know, alimony in a civil court. So this was really, you know, her livelihood. So I guess, you know, and I mean, also considering that as a wife she was in reality obligated to a lot of things. But they're just not enumerated in the document. It's a nice thing to know that, you know, in modern times, it's not as necessary of a document.
There's been some progress.
Financial stability.
There's been some progress since the Middle Ages in that regard. Yes. Jessica, let me stay with you for just a minute, and let me remind listeners, if you tuned in late, we're talking with Rafe Melhado and his new spouse, Jessica Kavanaugh. Jessica, are you keeping the Kavanaugh name, or are you changing, or what's the custom in Orthodox Judaism, or is there one about names?
The custom is generally whatever the local custom, as you know, meaning sort of American custom, which, I mean, in recent years has sort of changed significantly. It used to be that you would always, without question, change your name. And I think that is all very common in the community. But also I think there's more people either keeping their name or hyphenating or doing a little bit of both. And I think at this point I'm leaning towards hyphenating, although it'll be quite a mouthful. But I think there's so many people that know me by my maiden name, and also, and it is my name, you know, and I have a hard time sort of giving it up, I guess.
So you're leaning toward Jessica Kavanaugh Melhado.
Yes, that is, although no decision has been made final yet.
I see. All right. Well, I thought maybe we'd get a news announcement right here.
Well, maybe in a few weeks I'll give you the privilege anyway.
Well, do call us first. Rafe, you and Jessica spent a year in Israel. Was that after graduation from college?
Yeah, I had graduated in May of 2005, and I remained in Urbana for Jessica's senior year in college, which was the following year. And I did home renovation in the community with my own company while Jessica finished up with school. And once she graduated, then we left to go to Pardes.
And what is Pardes?
Well, Pardes literally means an orchard, and it's actually the Hebrew word from which the English word paradise is derived. And
as in garden of?
Well, that's the Garden of Eden. Paradise-like place is derived from the word for orchard. And this is an institution that styles itself as a yeshiva, although it's a very unusual yeshiva in that it accepts men and women together, and it accepts a lot of different kinds of Jews, whereas many yeshivot cater to one particular sort of Jew.
Yeshiva and shivot. Those words?
Yeshiva means literally sitting, and it refers to it's a description of Jewish learning, essentially. You sit down with a friend and learn Jewish texts together. So yeshiva it refers to basically a Jewish school.
And could you do that as a couple?
Well, Pardes is probably one of the only places that you could do that as a couple. Certainly in the Orthodox world, it's the only place you could do it as a couple. But there are other yeshivas that are not Orthodox where you could do that.
And Pardes is where? Where is it located?
It's in Jerusalem.
Which part?
Well, it's in the southeast. It's actually very, very close to the Green Line, although you really don't notice that at all.
And what's the Green Line?
The Green Line is the line separating Israel from the West Bank, and where exactly it is a subject of great controversy, in that, at least in the part of Jerusalem where we lived, you would be able to cross the Green Line and not really notice that you had. It would still feel like you were in Israel.
So there's not a wall there at this point?
Well, not where we lived. You could probably get up on top of our house and see where the wall was that is in a different part of Jerusalem.
So the wall is not following the Green Line everywhere?
That's correct.
Okay. Well, we'll get back to that later, and perhaps there'll be callers with questions about that. But before we do, let me just remind listeners, this is a live call-in show every Sunday evening from 5 to 6 p.m. Central Time here in Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, coming from University of Illinois, WILL AM 580. If you would like to be a part of this program, it's very easy if you have access to a telephone. You may call us toll-free wherever this program is heard, including on the Internet, if you're within the continental U.S., not sadly from Israel. You may use 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. If you're in Champaign-Urbana, help keep that line free, the toll-free line, available by using a local number, 333-9455, for those in Champaign-Urbana, and that'll get you to several local lines. That's 333-WILL, the toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455, if you have questions or comments for our guests. We're talking to Jessica Cavanaugh and Rafe Delgado. Tell us about your year. First, what had you studied here at the University of Illinois, Rafe, before you left for Israel this time?
Well, it took me a long time to decide what I wanted to study. When I finally did, I studied history, and I really loved it on an intellectual level, though I'm not entirely sure what I'm going to do with it. To the extent that they allowed me to focus, then I focused on the British colonial period in the Middle East.
And what about you, Jessica?
I was a religious studies major with a concentration in religion and culture, which meant that I sort of looked at the history of many religions and their practices, as well as taking classes in anthropology, psychology, and sociology as a way of sort of broadening my understanding of religion's role in society.
So both of you were in the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences, the Humanities, History, and Religious Studies. Were your parents concerned about, hey, this isn't training you to get a job right out of college, or were they fairly at ease about that?
Well, my goal was to work in the Jewish community. So a degree in religious studies is one of the ways that you can get into the field. I also did a lot of leadership and just general activities with the Hillel Foundation on campus, and that really sort of broadened my resume as well. So that those two combined actually led pretty successfully into my getting a job here in Chicago at the Jewish Federation.
And what about you, Rafe?
Well, I think I went into history with the understanding that I would probably need to go back to school and continue my education to be more employable, because I knew that I probably did not want to be a professional historian. So I'm still a career in the making, and my folks were not too worried about it, so long as that I did plan to go back to school, that it did not bother them.
We have a caller waiting on our toll-free line, line number 4. Yes, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
I don't know how recently your guests were in Israel, but I wanted to ask, it's been so many years since I've been there, I don't know what the politics are like. Does a majority of Israel still think peace with the Arabs by sharing land is a viable option?
Could you hear the question? Yes?
Does the majority of the population of Israel still think that by giving away land, that is the ultimate solution for peace?
I hear the question, and it looks like we've temporarily lost our line with our guests in Chicago. Let me just follow up. Have you ever been to Israel yourself, caller?
Yes, I was there 25 years ago.
What was the occasion of your visit?
Oh, I just took 3 weeks and traveled throughout Israel. And at that time, there was still talk of giving back a lot of the land. And I believe...
The idea of swapping land for peace was the talk then, I'm sure. Sorry, we're having a little technical difficulty. Jessica, are you and Rafe there?
Just got back, though. We missed the question.
Okay. And sadly, we've lost the caller, but let me repeat the question. He was in Israel 25 years ago, and he was saying he was there for 3 weeks, and as he traveled around, one of the hot options at that time was the whole notion of trading land for peace to designate a certain part of the greater Israel as Palestinian territory in exchange for agreements from the Palestinian authorities that there'd be a lessening of the violence. He was asking if that's still an option that's talked about among Israelis today, among the Israelis in Israel.
I think what was interesting in terms of the peace process while we were there, and just the political process in general, was the sort of overwhelming sense of not being sure where they were going. After Sharon had his stroke, and then Olmert came into power, and then the war in Lebanon, I think things were very unclear as to where they were going. And it seemed that a lot of ideas that were on the table were still on the table, but nobody was really sure what would be the next step and whether it would make sense to try things, to try land for peace, or if they should try other options. People really seemed to feel, especially as elections became more and more clear that they would be happening, people really seemed to feel that there was a lack of leadership, but also a lack of options in terms of what to do next. Although, I mean, even with that feeling, they were still the Israelis were very much going about their daily life and sort of seemed to have a little bit of faith that there would be some kind of solution somewhere. So I don't know if Land for Peace was really on the table entirely, but it was. I think it's on the table as much as the rest of the options seem to be at this point.
And Rafe, anything you'd like to add?
Yeah, I think something that I've noticed from maps of the region that you see in the media is that the area looks very large on a map. And if you think about distances, both Israel and the territories that the Palestinians are requesting for their state are very, very small. And Israel is 290 miles tall and only 70 miles wide. And I think some Israelis, at least, are very fearful about the idea of giving land for peace because they don't have that much. Now, I think the way the Palestinians think about it is, well, you've got more than we do, so come on. And there are definitely a number of Israelis that agree with that point. I would say just in terms of our experiences going to eat Shabbat lunch at different people's houses, we saw a wide range of opinion. Some people were very much in favor of land for peace, and some people were very opposed to it.
Let me apologize to our caller who asked that very good question for losing you because of technical problems. But if you want to follow up, please do call again. Happy to have you follow up that question. But in the meantime, let me give the phone numbers again for others who might like to ask a question to our guests. 333-9455 is the number in Champaign-Urbana. Elsewhere, a toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Before the caller asked the question, I was asking about your undergraduate experience. And Jessica, you said you were a religious studies major. We have a wonderful religious studies program here at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. It's quite diverse. You can study any of the world's major religions. You can concentrate in one or more of them, as well as getting a broad understanding of the history of religions. But there's no opportunity for graduate study here in that particular field. It's just a program. The religious studies does not even have departmental status, which I've always regretted, which meant that you didn't have much choice, Jessica, did you? After you finished a major here, you would have had to go to another school if you wanted to get a master's or a PhD in that particular study, right?
Yeah.
Did that bother you, or are there some of your classmates? I would think there'd be some people who would really want to stay here and continue studying with some of the marvelous professors that are here in that field.
I think it did bother certain people. I think I always knew that I didn't want to go into sort of the academic study of religion. I either wanted to sort of go into nonprofit management and work in the Jewish community or do things with Jewish education, which would require, obviously, both of those further degrees. But I also knew that that wouldn't be the kind of thing, really, that I could study at the U of I in Champaign. And that didn't bother me because I really enjoyed my time at the U of I and to having that as a four-year experience and then moving on from there, it seemed to be a great opportunity for me. But I know that there were definitely people who really enjoyed the professors. And even I can think of professors that it would have been nice to be able to study further with. And it's a shame that there's not really that opportunity for graduate study.
Now, did your year in study in Jerusalem result in an additional degree?
No. It's there are opportunities at the school to get a master's in education, but that was a separate program from the program that we were in. Our program would be sort of comparable to, say, a junior year abroad that maybe didn't count towards somebody's major or a fellowship that is sort of looks nice on a resume and really increases the knowledge of the participant, but you don't get a specific degree from it.
Sure. Tell us a little bit more about the particular course of study that you and Rafe did for that year in Israel.
Sure. The day-to-day structure is very much similar to your traditional yeshiva in that we study Talmud, which is the oral law, although it is written down, and we study also Torah in the morning as well, so alternating days.
Now, that would be with a teacher or just with two people reading it and talking about it?
A combination of both, actually. The classes in the mornings were about 3.5 hours long, and about an hour to an hour and a half of that would be in a class of about 15 people with a professor, generally a rabbi, who would be discussing a specific section with you, either going over something done previously or introducing new material. And then we would go to the Beit Midrash, which was basically sort of a big library with lots of tables. And each pair would sit at a table and discuss the section that was given with, the resources available in the Beit Midrash, the dictionaries, other professors, other rabbis, and your fellow classmates as well. And then we would come back into the class and to discuss again. So that was sort of the basic structure of most of the classes. Even in the afternoon, the classes, we would do something similar, although those classes were generally shorter, and though often on topics that were slightly less traditional for a yeshiva, such as I took one on the principles of faith of Maimonides, which, while that does seem sort of like a traditional topic, the idea of studying faith is not really something that's done in a yeshiva. Yeshiva is generally like entirely text-based. And Maimonides was a medieval thinker about Jewish subjects, and he came up with his own list of principles of faith that are at least attributed to him. There's some sort of controversy as to whether it is actually his. Those principles were sort of the basis for this class that we had and that I had in the afternoons. Now, the school is also divided up into levels. I had done some Talmud study previously, and I had a reasonably good level of Hebrew, so I was in a middle level of Talmud study and a middle level of Torah study. Rafe has done yeshiva study previously, so he was in a higher level, and there were a number of students who were in lower levels as well. So, and the nice thing was there were also chances to have classes with people who were both lower and higher than your level. So you got a little bit of everything, you know, a sort of peer group that was at your level and then being able to interact with people on all levels.
I want to ask some more detailed questions about your experience there. I find it very interesting, but we're about halfway through this program, and let me just remind listeners, this is Keeping the Faith. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for this weekly program. It's an hour long from 5 to 6, and we welcome your questions and comments. Do call us at 1-800-222-9455. That's a toll-free number. Or in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. This is a radio service of the University of Illinois College of Communications, which will soon be getting a new name here at the University of Illinois, WILL AM 580. This service is supported by our listeners, and many have been very generous to support WILL, both AM and FM and TV, over many years, and I encourage you to continue as you think of your charitable giving to include WILL. Coming up on this program next week, we have finished now our sort of mini-series on Judaism, various aspects of Judaism that corresponds with the celebration of Rosh Hashanah, the 10-day period of the new year, which is happening right now for Jews in all over the world. Coming up next week, we'll be talking about the United Way here in Champaign-Urbana in Champaign County with Lynn Jones and Emmy Fisher. Brett Smith will be our guest on September 30. He's the University Baptist campus minister, pastor of University Baptist Church in Champaign. He'll be talking about campus ministry generally throughout the United States. And on October 7, we'll have a representative from CIMIC, the Central Illinois Mosque and Islamic Center, Shaquille Mustafa. I mentioned my name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the director of the University YMCA, which provides support for Keeping the Faith. Coming up at the Y this week on Tuesday is a public forum on race and ethnicity. And there was a nice article in the local newspaper about this program, including our forum. There are several performances this coming week at Krannert Center for the Performing Arts that deal with racial language, racial slurs, and three young men from Los Angeles coming from different ethnic backgrounds have written about that. and written an interesting play that they perform. They've gone to many different university campuses. They're here at the U of I next week. I'm not sure if there are tickets available for the performances. They were considering adding a third performance since the first two were sold out. There is still space to come to the forum where these three young men will be speaking at the University Y. It does require tickets, however, but the tickets are free. Get them at Credit Center. You can call 333-6280 during the week or email crantix, K-R-A-N-T-I-X, at uiuc.edu. Or go to the Credit Center website, creditcenter.com. That's Tuesday noon at the Y. The Thai Eatery provides good food. If you'd like to call the Y in advance to reserve a lunch, you may do that, 337-1500, or simply come by the Y. There'll be plenty of food. Coming up, our Friday forum speaker is Lewis Sell. He'll be speaking Friday noon at the Y on Milosevic and the destruction of Yugoslavia, and particularly the creation and development of the American University in Kosovo. Fascinating topic. That's this Friday, September 21st, noon at the Y. Again, call 337-1500 if you'd like to reserve a wonderful Thai lunch. Or you could bring your own, or simply come and listen to the free lecture. Well, let's get back to our guests. We have several callers waiting. Let's go to line number four, and I'll try to do this without losing our guests. Line number four, can you hear me?
Yes, I'm calling from Chicago. Thank you for an interesting program.
Yes, go ahead.
I have a question for your gentleman guest. He mentioned he had studied the effects of British colonialism. I last year read Wangari Maathai's memoir Unbowed, and the effects of British colonialism in Kenya affected the land. They planted inappropriate crops, which led to disaster in a lot of ways. I also saw during the International Women's Film Festival at Loyola University up here, a film called The Color of Olives about a Palestinian family who had been fenced in. They refused to leave the land that the trees had been there in the father's family for maybe 1,000 years, and they were suffering very greatly. Can the relationship of the people in Israel and of the whole region to the land be somehow dealt with? How does this relate to what happened with the British in Israel and so on and so forth? I'd like to hear something about that.
Very good question. Rafe, could you hear the question?
I could.
And you'd spoken earlier about how small the whole area of Israel and Palestine are, 290 miles by 70 miles, the whole combined country. Any response to the question about land and colonialism and the present situation with Palestine?
Well, I think the attitude that the British took to the way that they managed a lot of the lands in the Middle East is that they were looking at it from their own perspective, that is to say, how is what we are doing here going to be better for us? And I think that is the root of a lot of the frustration that people in the region have with the British government, is that you weren't thinking about us, and we were the ones who had to deal with the very real consequences of what you guys did. So I think if you're a British administrator, you might not have had some of the same concerns about land. You wouldn't be so worried about how is my land tenure policy going to affect the local people? It's how is it going to be good for me? So I think a lot of the trouble, I mean, remembering this film, I didn't actually watch the film in question, although I've heard about it, The Color of Olive. I think we're talking specifically about Israel. The British got themselves in a lot of trouble with the Balfour Declaration, because the wording of it was very, very ambiguous. And basically what happened is that the local Arab population in what was then called Palestine and the local Jewish population both thought, oh, the Balfour Declaration promises us a state in the region. And part of the trouble that the British had throughout the entire mandatory period is that they never came out and clarified, well, what did we mean when we published this Balfour Declaration? And essentially when they left, they didn't leave with the idea that they would be handing over control in any way that would be helpful to the people in the area. They left with the idea that, well, we're spending, you know, an absurd amount of money every day in this place where people aren't getting along and we're the targets of both sides, so let's just leave. And to a large extent, the way that the land was appropriated in the late 40s in Israel has a lot to do with what happened with the situation on the ground after the British left, and it really wasn't planned. The United Nations voted on borders for Israel, and what would they weren't sure if it was going to be Palestine. They called it an Arab state, so define that as what you will. Those borders are not the borders that you see today, and that has to do with the way that the 1948 war between the Arab governments of the region and what was then Israel took place. So essentially, it's very difficult to say, you know, what could be done about the land relationships now. I think a lot of what goes on is that the Israeli government is very interested in getting control over as much land as possible, not merely for its own sake, but because the borders of Israel create a very large frontier for the amount of land that they have. And I think a lot of what they're trying to do is, you know, they're justifying their land grabs as security interests. And I think this is very, very frustrating to people like the fellow in that movie, The Color of Olive, because the Israeli government, I would say, is not particularly interested in the way that particular pieces of land and the usages of that land affects the people on the land. I think they're looking at it much more from the outside. We need to accomplish the following goals in this area, whether it be for security or agriculture or whatever, and this is how we do it. And I think, unfortunately, there's a lot of insensitivity that goes on in the people who are responsible for those decisions.
It's an ongoing tragedy, isn't it?
And I know controlling water rights and access in that very arid area is also an important concern.
That's correct. Actually, one of the opportunities that we had while we were in Israel was a friend of ours who we met actually through Pardes, who lives in Switzerland, was able to take us on a tour of a number of the Israeli Arab towns in and around Nazareth. And one of the places that we went was to an Arab village where the only way that the local people could get water from the Israeli government was to bind up together in a huge cooperative that I think had over 100 different farmers on it. And they were actually successfully able to lobby to get water allocation from the Israeli government. But, I mean, it took a massive community organization for that to happen. And I have to say, I mean, the Israeli Water Authority is not very nice to the Israelis either. So, you know, that's a whole another kettle of fish right there. And a big part of the problem is that Syria is allowed to take water from the headwaters of the Sea of Galilee. And this means that the Galilee is always, you know, Israel takes from the Galilee itself. So you have two very populous countries taking a lot of water from what is basically a teeny little lake, and it's always too low, and then everything that is below the lake is too low. So the Jordan River is like 6 feet wide, and the Dead Sea is sinking every year, so it's a big problem. I don't really know how to solve it.
Oh, thank you. Very informative.
Thank you for the call. Appreciate it. Let's go to another caller who's waiting on line number one. Thank you for your patience. Go ahead.
So my question was related to the water usage. About 6-7 years ago, there was a professor from New York who came and talked on the water issue relating to Palestinians and Israelis, and he made a point that they were going to need to be cooperating. And so I was wondering what you found, well, even for your own access to drinkable water.
Jessica, would you like to respond to that question?
Sure.
Sure. We had an apartment in Jerusalem, and it was very interesting. The access to water there was excellent. The water itself is very drinkable. The quality of the water is always depends on where you are. The water was very hard because Jerusalem is in a mountainous area, so there was a lot of minerals in the water, but not any more than you would get in the United States. And our bills for water, as residents, were really not much higher than when I lived in an apartment in Urbana, which we both found very surprising. That knowing the situation for the water, that it would be that way. Now, on one of our Pardes had a program of retreats that we would go on every few months to different regions of Israel for a weekend. And during one of these retreats, we had somebody speak about this very topic, the water situation. And it seems that the water authority in Israel operates on a system of sort of what was historically the case, as most water policy operates on a similar idea that historically whoever used the water gets the water, and even if the situation changes, that situation remains the same. So what that means is that Jerusalem gets a very large supply of water, always. And various kibbutzim and towns and villages that have been on the map, so to speak, for a long time, they get their allocation as well.
What about the newer settlements?
Hmm?
What about the newer settlements in Palestinian territory?
I think they sort of work out their arrangements as they're going, and I think it depends on how much support they have. Those settlements had and have from the government. If the settlement at the time it was built had a lot of government support, I'm sure they probably didn't have too much trouble. As for the more recent development of what are basically illegal settlements and in various areas, I'm sure they probably have a much more difficult time getting a water allocation. As Rafe mentioned, the Arab-Israeli village that had to work very hard to get water to with which they could irrigate their fields, that happens to Israelis as well, sort of Jewish Israelis. In that, if you're trying to do something new, then it becomes very difficult. And the other thing is also that if you don't use your water allocation 1 year, you will lose it the next year. So there's no incentive
to save
water,
or conserve, yes.
Because you won't get it again. And the guy who was speaking mentioned to us that there was sort of an idea, sort of rumblings of an idea of if somebody didn't use their water, then they could sell it to somebody else who needed it. But apparently the bureaucracy is such that nothing really has been able to be changed in a very long time. The situation is not very good. You have to understand, with Israel being such a small country, there are aquifers underneath Israel that are in better or worse health, but most of their water comes from other countries, or at least travels through other countries. And so that's when the historical use of the water comes into play again, where you have, a country, Turkey takes a certain amount of the water from the headwaters of the Euphrates, and then that sort of everybody takes a little bit, carries on all the way through, meaning that the water just is not allocated in such a way that would make sense if you didn't know the history.
Very difficult negotiations internationally based on that. Caller, did you have another follow-up?
No, thanks for the information.
Well, thank you very much for the call. Let's go to line number two. Another caller's waiting. Line number two, are you still there?
Yes, I'm here.
Yes, go ahead, please.
I'm wondering, what are your guest views about the Palestine situation and how the government of Israel has treated the Palestinians?
Which of us would you like to answer that?
Either one, sir.
Okay, well, I think that a big thing that is frustrating for both sides right now, and is hard for me to watch, certainly, is the failure of the Oslo Accords in the 90s. Everybody at the time was expecting that they would lead to a final resolution, or at least those people who were not cynical were expecting that it would lead to a final resolution in which borders would be declared and defended, and that eventually, hopefully, the sides might actually talk to each other in a functional way. What ended up happening with Oslo is that it divided the Palestinian territories into three groups called Areas A, B, and C. Area C is administered entirely by Israel. Area B is administered jointly by Israel and the Palestinian Authority. And Area A is administered entirely by the Palestinian Authority without reference to Israel. The trouble is, it sounds like three contiguous pieces. That is to say, you've got one chunk that's Area A, one that's B, and one that's C. In fact, C is a sort of a large swath. It's actually most of the Palestinian territory, certainly in the West Bank anyway. And there are little dots of B and A inside of it that don't touch each other. And the trouble is that whenever...
And Gaza was completely separate?
And Gaza is, well, Gaza's been separate since 1948. Oh. I mean, since even before that. Gaza has never touched the West Bank.
Yes.
And Gaza is a whole separate issue by itself in that Israel controls a lot of the access to its airspace and water space and its border crossings. And the effect is that basically whenever Israel gets nervous about its security situation, then it will close off access between the pieces of the Palestinian Authority such that movement between these little islands of B and C, or B and A, is virtually impossible. And again, if we're remembering how little the area is, you need these people to be able to communicate with each other and to move goods between areas for them to be able to live. I mean, just on a humanitarian level, how are you going to get food across? How are you going to, you know, get water and emergency services, medical services? It's very difficult when these areas are closed off. Now, I think the Israeli perspective is, well, every time we open the flow of traffic between these areas, although most of the people are just regular people and they're doing what they're supposed to, this also opens the floodgate, if you will, to those people who are trying to commit terrorist acts in Israel. And so they justify a lot of the things that they would do that ordinarily might not sound so nice because they're worried about themselves and they've got to look after their own. And I think that it looks very bleak right now. I think Israel is definitely in a better position on many, many counts and has the ability, I would say, more to control what's going to happen in the future. And I think that because you can't ask, you know, what do the Israelis think about such and such, because they're bitterly divided amongst themselves, too. And you get wildly left and wildly right-wing opinions and every possible range of opinions in between, and they argue bitterly about it all the time. And really what is unfortunate, at least, about Sharon's stroke is that, for good or bad, a lot of people seem to agree with what he was trying to do towards the end of his conscious life. And nobody really knew what to expect, but they figured that at least he would do something that was definitive, and that the legacy that he would lead or leave behind is, or would have been at least, something that, you know, would have shaped the region for the rest of its history. And that may have been good or bad. I'm not sure how he would have handled it. I mean, I was a little suspicious of his motives myself, but at least it would have been definitive. And now nobody knows what's going to happen, and, you know, Olmert certainly doesn't have the capacity to lead anyone into a broad decision-making process. And now everybody's looking back to the old characters like Bibi Netanyahu and Ehud Barak, and, you know, they need young blood, new blood, somebody who can go out and make a stand and get criticized for doing something, because unless somebody goes out and makes a definitive statement about what's going to happen to the West Bank, what's going to happen to Gaza, will they be connected or not, and go and do it, then it's just going to be the same old story with, you know, people in Israel being at least better off but still very worried and very tense, and people in the Palestinian territories having a very bleak future, and nothing's going to get solved. So, I'm very worried about what's going to happen, but I can't say for sure what will.
Thank you, caller. We're down to our last 30 seconds or so. Jessica, do you want to respond to that question?
Well, I think the general Israeli perspective right now seemed to be very unsure and unclear. I think there was definitely a feeling of Sharon being the best last hope and then being unable to fulfill it. And that was very hard for a lot of people, even if they weren't sure what he was going to do or if they agreed with what he was going to do. They were hopeful that he would at least do something. And the situation for both sides, I think, is quite bleak. I think there's so many security problems or security worries that affect Israelis on so many levels, on very basic levels. And then similarly with the situation now with Hamas and Fatah having split up the region so much, that I think we're now dealing with an even more complicated situation, if that's even possible.
Well, thank you very much for responding to questions about some very big issues, as well as telling us about your very interesting year of Jewish studies in Jerusalem. And I want to thank our guests. Recently married, just 2 weeks ago, Rafe Melhado. Rafe's name is R-A-I-F, Melhado, M-E-L-H-A-D-O, and Jessica Kavanaugh. Thank you both for being on the program. Next week on Keeping the Faith, Lynn Jones and Emmy Fisher from United Way will be our guests. Reverend Brett Smith, September 30th, talking about campus ministry in the U.S. and from the Central Illinois Mosque and Islamic Center, October 7, Shaquille Mustafa. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for this program and director of the University YMCA. We're broadcasting from Campbell Hall for Public Telecommunications, thanks to the generosity of Alice and Robert Campbell. And I might just mention that there's a similar naming opportunity available for someone who might like to contribute to the renovation of the University YMCA. Give me a call, University Y, 337-1500. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Celebrate this year with a visit to the Fae Folk. I'm Jim Fleming. Next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge, we'll have an hour filled with stories of changelings and other kin, fairy courts and green children. We'll conjure up a world of enchantment. But beware, there are no Tinkerbells in the world. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7 here on WILL Urbana.
A visit to the dentist, standing in line at the DMV, dinner with the in-laws, pledge drives. These are all things we wish could be shorter. We're not big fans of long pledge drives either. You can make our fall fund drive short by going online now to willpledge.org and contributing to our member match fund. Then tune into our Power Hour at 7 a.m. on Thursday, October 11th, where we will raise a whole day's worth of pledges in 1 hour. Shorter pledge drives. How about that?
Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, partly cloudy with a low in the lower 50s and southeast winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, mostly sunny and warmer with a high in the lower 80s and southeast winds 15 to 20 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with a low in the upper 50s and south winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. It's 6 p.m. This American Life is next.